Campus FM presents a talk as part of the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Arts Pedagogical Polity. This talk will be delivered by Professor John Baldacchino.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the first seminar in the 12th annual seminar series Work in Progress in the Social Studies. Tonight we will be hearing Professor John Baldacchino from Columbia University Teachers College giving a paper on arts pedagogical polity. But we also have, and this will interest our radio audience as well as the people attending tonight, we also have two further seminars planned before the Easter break. Next Monday, March 23rd, Dr. John Mitchell, reader in anthropology at the University of Sussex, will give a paper on performing statues. And he will examine in his paper the significance of statues in popular Catholicism. So that's next Monday here, room 124, Mediterranean Institute, 6 to 8 p.m., March 23rd. And again, before Easter, on Thursday, 2nd April, Professor Martin Stokes, well-known ethnomusicologist at St. John's College, Oxford University, will be giving a paper entitled Globalization and Music. So that is on Thursday, 2nd April, here again, room 124, Mediterranean Institute. And then after Easter, we have three more Work in Progress seminars planned, which should be very interesting and about which we will inform you. Well, now what I would like to do is I would like to introduce tonight's speaker, Professor John Baldacchino. John is Associate Professor of Art and Art Education at Columbia University's Teachers College, New York, where he teaches philosophy of art and education, radical philosophy, critical theory, studio and pedagogy, and also he teaches the philosophy of art in higher education. Professor Baldacchino was educated in Malta and the United Kingdom. He received his Bachelor's of Education degree from the University of Malta and his Master's and Doctorate from the University of Warwick in England. Before taking up his post as Associate Professor of Art and Art Education at Columbia University's Teachers College, he was a reader in critical theory at the Robert Gordon University in Scotland, and before that, lecturer in art education and cultural theory at the University of Warwick. He's published many articles in peer-reviewed journals, but also a number of books. Among his books, he is the author of Post-Marxist Marxism, Questioning the Answer, in 1996, Easels of Utopia, Arts, Fact, Returned, 1998, Avant Nostalgia, An Excuse to Pause, published by Usopia in 2002, and his most recent book is Education Beyond Education, Self and the Imaginary in Maxine Green's Philosophy, and that was published in 2008. At the moment, he's working on two book projects. One has the provisional title, Makings of the Sea on Mediterranean Aesthetics. That looks very, very interesting indeed. And that's forthcoming, hopefully, in 2009. And then forthcoming in 2010, John is working on another title, Art's Way Out, Exit Pedagogy and the Cultural Condition. And this last book, Exit Pedagogy and the Cultural Condition, is in fact the book in progress, which I believe is the subject of this evening's talk. So we want to extend a warm welcome to a man who is returning to home ground, Professor John Baldacchino.
Thank you. I just wanted to, first of all, wanted to thank you all for coming and thank Professor Clough for inviting me and Professor Mayo and all the colleagues from the University of Malta. It's good to be back. I should tell you that this is the first time ever I've ever given a lecture in the University of Malta. I was here as a student before 1884 and then 1889, so I feel kind of sort of quite emotional being here. What I wanted to do today is just, I thought sort of I should mention a bit or talk a bit about the recent book which we just published, The Education Beyond Education, but particularly talk about where I kind of leave that book. The reason I decided not to talk about Mediterranean aesthetics, the reason for that actually, although that book is a book which is almost like a kind of love's work, it's something which I've been working on for a while. And as you can see, I mean, you know, me coming from Malta and coming from the Mediterranean, that's a subject which is really close to my heart. However, I thought it would be better if I kind of sort of work more towards the one I'm doing now, the education book, partly because the Mediterranean book was already halfway through when I got contract to write a book on Maxine. And as you may know, Maxine Green actually is still teaching Teachers College, Columbia University, where she's an emeritus professor. She is in the young age of 92, and for those who know her work, actually, she's been kind of a pioneer in a very radical kind of philosophy, which has inspired a lot of people, especially in talking about aesthetics education, but also the whole idea of how education and sort of polity, within the context of a liberal tradition, understood liberal tradition, this is more from the European context, rather than kind of a liberal, as the Americans would say, liberal of the left, where there is that kind of vision. As you may know as well, Teachers College is still kind of haunted by the ghost of John Dewey. He used to teach both at Teachers College and on main campus at Columbia. And so that kind of tradition actually has been very, very strong. It's also inevitable. However, what Maxine's work does is that she goes beyond, although she goes through John Dewey and the other traditions, and especially the kind of American liberal tradition, but also she brings into that, and by bringing that into sort of the tradition she goes beyond, she brings into a continental philosophical point of view, particularly when she's writing, you know, she started her career in the 50s, but I mean the sort of, she took full blossom actually of her work in the 60s, and with a book entitled Existential Encounters for Teachers, which was a book that she wrote together, she put together actually in 3 weeks, she says, which was a compendium of existential philosophers, both from America and both from the United, from Europe. But also there is her voice which kind of brings them together. So there are these kind of, you know, Camus, Kierkegaard and all the others, and then suddenly you have her intervention coming in. And it was done with a very strong preoccupation of the state of education in those days and also the state of the teacher. But then actually her masterpiece, and this is kind of strange, it's not unkind to say that one of her major books actually is one of her first books, is called Teacher Stranger, which unfortunately is out of print these days. Which actually heralded, kind of, you know, put her on the on a very original standpoint in terms of taking the notion of the stranger and the existentialist point of view, and then putting the teacher in it. And the teacher actually becomes almost like a figure coming out of Camus, but also the teacher is also engaging with the quiddities, if you like, of a Kierkegaard. Plus, the teacher also becomes a radical, because the teacher becomes a radical by being a stranger. The teacher is not there looking at the ordinary and just saying, ah, okay, we'll do whatever we've been doing. The teacher becomes also an artist in the way that the teacher is there as a dissenter. The teacher is there as a transgressor, if you like. The teacher is not there to just sort of engage in benign progressive education, but also the teacher is there to kind of challenge even that. So the kind of idea of the liberal who comes in within the kind of pragmatism that we've inherited in John Dewey, and I must say, if that wasn't there, that wouldn't sort of, you know, Maxine Green wouldn't have been able to engage with that. The teacher becomes there as a catalyst of change in a way that he is estranged voluntarily. It's almost like the artist, and almost like art estranges itself from reality as Marcuse tells us in his aesthetic dimension. By the way, Marcuse actually becomes quite a figure in Maxine's work. Remember, it was the 60s. So that actually creates a situation of uncomfort. It creates a situation where you start questioning, but also creates a situation of what Maxine calls wide awakeness, which again she takes from another philosopher, Alfred Schütz, in those days in the 60s and 70s, who actually brought into the United States, although Alfred Schütz was, as you know, he was European, but then he moved into the United States and worked mainly in business. But he brings in philosophers like Husserl, he brings in philosophers also like Bergson, and he brings them in there, and suddenly there's this kind of notion, because as you know, in the United States, you know, psychology was prevalent in education studies, but then suddenly, you know, someone like Schütz, who was very popular in the 70s, he brings in this kind of other dimension. I mean, these days people talk about Csikszentmihalyi, and they talk about flow, and he's a very kind of, but actually, you know, Husserl brings up sort of Bergson's idea, which anticipates a lot of stuff which is being used today. And Green was there, I mean, picking up that, and she formed part of that kind of humanist movement, but also she was in the 60s when there were these kind of, you know, students' rights. She was in Teachers College when the students moved from Columbia and then kind of, you know, they threw them out and then they moved into Teachers College. So she was there, and she writes a lot about that. she praises this whole idea of leaping, taking the leap, taking the risk. So the aesthetics, but also the pedagogy, if you like, the pedagogical polity becomes a notion of risk. It becomes an idea of not simply taking on from where you are and move into this kind of teleological progress, which somehow is assumed to guarantee some kind of sort of good result. But she actually goes against that. She says, no, we have to take that kind of risk. We have to sort of risk everything. We have to take the leap. And for those who are familiar with Dewey even, you find that actually what she does, she kind of starts excavating Dewey's work and going back to some of his Hegelian origins. So bringing in literature, because she came from English at first, I mean, you know, as a kind of, you know, she studied English literature and she studied English education, but bringing in that into philosophy, that also opened up the whole idea of, she democratized in a good way, like in a very tangible way, but also in a critical way, education by actually inviting in the teachers to come in as strangers, but also engaging with art. Engaging with the arts, not simply just to become one or some kind of, you know, nirvana-like engagement with the arts, but also to look at the arts and engaging with the criticality of art. And so when I decided to write a book about her, I thought, well, I mean, if you, as you know, there are various books on her, but they are mainly, there are two main books actually, one edited by Janet Miller and Bill Ayer, and another one. And these books are all a compendia of essays on Maxine Green. So there's no one book written by one author specifically on her work. And I decided that I don't want to write a biography, partly because I don't know how to write biographies, and secondly because I was interested in philosophy. So I engaged with her philosophy, and particularly I focused on the notion of the self and the whole idea of the imaginary, rather than just the imagination. Because as you know, one of her major books is the Releasing the Imagination. But also other books like Variations on the Blue Guitar deal with the whole idea of aesthetic pedagogy through the notion of the self. But what I wanted to do as well is I wanted to engage with her as if I was engaging with her in dialogue. Now, the thing which is which you need to bear in mind is that when I asked Maxine, I said, look, I would like to write a book about your work, she told me, no, she went all modest on me. And I kind of, you know, asked friends of mine who knew her more, and I thought, what's that? They said, well, she's very nervous about people writing biographies about her. And I thought, look, I'm not going to write a biography, I just want to engage with your work. And she actually told me, okay, then go do it, but I don't want to be engaged in it because I want to see where you're going with this. So I just give you all the freedom, just go for it. So so I was very grateful for her to do that. And what I did is just engage with her work as if I'm engaging with a dialogue. The beauty of this is that her work, if you read her work, you'll find that she's entirely engaging with dialogue with all these interlocutors. So there is a dialogue, in her work it almost becomes like a dialogue with Hannah Arendt. Although she knew Hannah Arendt and also she took some classes with her in New School, but actually, you know, she's engaging with her work. So there are these kind of layers of narratives, one on top of the other. So it's almost like her work invites you to take on this kind of other layer. And I thought my work should be that taking on that layer, it invites others to take on another layer. So you keep building up. So when you look at the book, The Education Beyond Education, you find that once we start talking about education, it goes beyond education as a schooled form of education. It goes beyond education as an institutionalist form of learning. You're looking at learning, not schooling as such, but also you're looking at education that is much more comprehensive in the sense of going out with the school, as the Scots would say. Out with is a nice word because it's not without, but it's out with, it's out there. And also includes the school by going outside of it. It also involves that kind of polity which becomes part of learning once you are out with the institution, once you are out with the standardized forms that you know, education has been kind of hegemonized by. So the idea was that you start with this kind of engagement. I mean, if you look at the leaflet that I gave you, find sort of, you know, the chapters, sort of even the titles speak for themselves. But then as I move on, I start getting my own voice more and more into moving somewhere else, which then takes us to the kind of the next kind of project that I'm doing. Now you need to remember actually is that while I'm writing this, I'm also have been writing the Mediterranean book, which is quite interesting because recently I've been working using a book with my philosophy of art and education students by T.J. Clark called On the Side of Death. And T.J. Clark, you may know, he's also very much a political figure. He teaches in California And he's also, so he writes, he's an art historian, but also he writes books on politics. He forms part of a group called Retort. And he wrote a book, actually, which has to do with with issues of, you know, after the September the 11th. So you have T.J. Clark writing about, you know, September the 11th with a group of other political theorists. At the same time, he was writing this book on Poussin. Now, when he was writing this book on Poussin, actually, what he did, he decided to go, he had a grant, and he went to the Getty Center, and he looked at two books, two paintings by Poussin. He just said, what I'm going to do, I'm just going to look at these paintings by Poussin and take notes, as an art historian would do. But then he realized, he said, what I might do, actually, is publish the notes. So the way he was writing about the art, while he is also writing a political text, there are these two texts going on. So although there is no reference to the Mediterranean here, while I'm writing this, I'm also writing about Montale, I'm writing about Kazantzakis, I'm writing about the others. They are all there sort of somewhere else. So, and they are still there somewhere else while I'm writing also this. So, and it's kind of the life of the person who decides to invest his life in education, where although you have your own specialism, actually, and you do that, you also have to deal, I mean, this is the kind of school, actually, going on in your mind. So you need to deal with that. And which takes me to this book, which I'm working now, or this project, I'd rather call it a project, which actually looks back at some of the essays which I've written before, but also it takes on from where I left. And I want to mention three kind of concepts here, which hopefully would clarify the whole idea of arts pedagogical polity. For me, the argument is that education needs to go into different spaces. Education takes you into different spaces. Learning takes you into different spaces. Learning as a political act, if you like, takes you there. And it takes you to three spaces, which we take from mainly from Greek philosophy. It takes you to the polis, it takes you to the agon, and it takes you to the kora. And which broadly correspond, if you like, to the political as a community. It takes you to the polemical, because the agon is a space within which you can kind of, you know, engage, within which you can solve disputes, within which you can engage with disputes, and education becomes a form of dispute, as we know. But also takes you to the kora, which, as you know, in Plato, in Timaeus, you know, Plato talks about three realms, if you like. One is the logos, which is the word. The other one is the mythos, which is the kind of representation. And I'm kind of, you know, taking shortcuts here. But the other one is the kora. And you may know that Kristeva and Derrida both wrote about the kora in different ways. And the kora is that kind of third space, that third genre, which is indefinable. And if you try to define it, the kora disappears because it becomes logos or mythos. And as someone who teaches, you know, and engages with philosophy of art and engages with contemporary art practice, the kora is always there as one of those kind of words which allow us to talk about or allow us to articulate the inarticulable. And I think that if we're dealing with arts pedagogical polity, then we have to kind of talk about or engage with these kind of spaces, the space of the political, the space of the polemical, and the space of indefinable, which are interrelated places, if you like. And I'm reading this because, I mean, that's something which kind of would clarify it. So I also remain intent on trying to explain what it means to argue for an education that must be posed beyond itself. Now, this becomes interesting in terms of how contemporary art, particularly, but not just contemporary art, art in general, art in its own kind of essence, if there is such a thing, deals with this. How do we engage with art? If you're going to engage with art, especially in education, as sort of the first thing you think about, is that you find yourself dealing with art as an instrument of learning, art as a machine of learning, art as something, as a space within which you learn. But that actually, what it does, it suppresses art into a formalized kind of thing. It becomes the kind of autonomous form in terms of aesthetics, which Marcuse tells us is necessary in order to be able to kind of, you know, as you know, Marcuse's actually aesthetic dimension is a polemic with some of the, it forms part of the whole polemic within the Marxist aesthetic field, which kind of was characterized by him, by Adorno, by Lukács, by Brecht, and by others, and they all disagreed. I mean, they all kind of sort of were disagreeing, especially on the point of autonomy. And this becomes kind of, you know, Maxim takes that, takes both his book on one-dimensionality and also the whole idea of the aesthetic, partly because the aesthetic then becomes a form which allows us to think beyond the immediate. It allows us also to think beyond the existent, but not as a form of mediation. And that was the whole thing, because the crux is, if you're going to take art as a mediator, then you risk taking art into it becoming an instrument of. And the whole thing about instrumentality, as we know, especially in learning, but also politically, is contentious, problematic. At least the way I see it. So how do we then sustain this kind of strange relationship? And how do we sustain the paradox? How do we sustain the aporia of art? But at the same time, try to kind of engage in issues which are political. How do we engage with issues of freedom? How do we engage with issues of emancipation? How do we engage with civil rights? Now, the big problem here is that once you try to settle for one argument, the argument dissolves itself. It becomes kind of dialectical immediately, because if you want to sustain this dialectic, then it kind of dissolves itself and goes somewhere else. And somehow, even in progressive education, and I mean, liberals actually tend to kind of look at this in a different way, because liberalism, people like Rorty and others, especially even Dewey, they kind of, you know, change the goalposts all the time. So you say, okay, well, what happens is that there's nothing fixed. And so what happens is you go to the contingency of things, and you go to the accident, you can kind of keep moving around, and you keep changing the rules according to what you have. They're slightly historicists, but they're not, actually. Or they claim they are historicists, but I don't think they are. And that creates a big problem, because then, as we know, with liberal politics, actually, it leaves us with no real handles to be able to sustain or to be able to engage with crises that come into the terms of, class issues, issues of rights and that kind of stuff. Because as Rorty tells us, you can be a private liberal, but you can, you know, be a public conservative. But that becomes a problem. You can be a private radical, but how could you be a private radical only? You could be a private radical, okay, fine. You can think, you know, freely, and you can be free thinker, you can do whatever you like. But I mean, what about the public realm? How does that work? So the intervention into the public realm then becomes problematic for liberals, because it could be violent. There is, as you know, there is a very interesting debate, or there was a very interesting debate between Zizek, Laclau, and Judy Butler. But also before that, there was quite an interesting debate between Rorty, Derrida, Laclau, and Critchley. And in Laclau's critique of Rorty's kind of assumptions on liberalism, actually, you know, Laclau brings in this kind of notion that even with emancipation, once you emancipate, in itself, emancipation could become a form of oppression. So, I mean, in education, even progressive education, even critical pedagogy, we still haven't solved that. Now, if you're going to put that within the context of art and art education, philosophies of art education have been trapped in this kind of much more social scientific thing. I know this is a social sciences kind of forum, but actually, when it comes to art, I think, methodologically speaking, we need to move out of the social sciences and we start sort of looking more at the kind of speculative grounds, within which then we can start to engage in how art can then allow us to exit that kind of realm, the exit the certainty of measure, exit the idea that you can kind of, you know, externalize forms of knowledge and look at them under the microscope and somehow even progressively come with some kind of conclusion which then allow us to move on. Art doesn't work like that. Now, I'm not saying that artists should become the politicians of tomorrow, but actually at least it allows us to think in a speculative manner. It allows us also to start sort of, you know, dealing with this kind of dialogue or paradox between the private and the public, the external and the internal. And that's where it becomes interesting, because then how on earth are you going to affect change? How on earth are you going to affect change politically in terms of externality and internality? You can say, well, the external and the internal are not relevant. They are just sort of, you know, categories which people talk about. But in effect, there is no such thing. But actually, there is. You know, there is the polity and there is what lies outside the polity, if that is possible. There is history and what lies outside history, if that is possible. But I mean, there is that kind of sort of dialogue. There is that also that paradox. And I think in terms of the arts, when we look at them as not forms of learning, but we look at them as how we can see an inherent pedagogical element within them. And when I say inherent pedagogical, I don't mean you can teach with them. That's instrumental. I'm saying that looking at art or the art, especially contemporary art, and what's going on there, and how then, what does it do for us as a form? I mean, what do we do with it? We just put it in a museum? What do we do with Beuys? What do we do with Duchamp? What do we do with Martin Creed? What do we do with, you know, a piece of paper crumpled and say that's a work of art? What do you do with that? Is that something which is a joke? But then even if it's a joke, I mean, how does the joke work politically? How does that take us somewhere else? Does it need to take us somewhere else, or does it just sort of stay there? And, you know, for people like me who's engaging with art schools, who's engaging with people teaching in art schools and also practicing the art form, those are questions which are very pertinent and very important, partly because the language in itself defies any explanation. But on the other hand, that's not an excuse for us to say, no, we're just these mystics who don't want to talk about it. That's not the case. It's the case that what we have, politically speaking, is a challenge in order to kind of engage with that. Now, how do you do that? And that's the big question. To me, there are various issues here. One has to do with, for example, and I'm just going to kind of, you know, this is work in progress, so there are no answers as yet. And probably there would never be answers, there would be more questions. But I mean, there might be a possibility of thinking about pedagogy as a form of exit rather than as a form of entrance. There might be an issue with the whole idea of inclusion. I mean, speaking from a position which is broadly thought of as progressive, whatever that means, which that means, you know, one step beyond simply being liberal. But then again, thinking about a position which might be radical, whatever that means, then we're dealing with issues of, say, inclusion. And as we know, inclusion has always been assumed as, you know, one of the commandments of education. Education must be inclusive. But inclusive into what? And inclusive of what? Does that include simply plurality? But how does that work? Because if you're going to include, then you could find yourself in a situation where, you know, while these forms of inclusion are presented as a democratization of the school and education, say, for example, the privileging of popular narratives, just to take one example, over what is misunderstood as the canonical and elitist character of aesthetics education, for example, or of art, you know, that in itself, that kind of critique, could be reinforcing the hegemony of a schooled notion of a popular visual culture that ultimately sustained the hegemony of the status quo. And I'm not saying that's the case, but I'm saying that might well be the case. And sometimes it happens, because actually we have had 20 years of progressive education. We've had more than 20 years of polemics in there. We have critical pedagogy firmly sort of established. Yet, the kind of the dynamics of the paradoxes that we engage with seems to have kind of, you know, still been there and not really discussed. And also, whenever we discuss, we always fall back onto this kind of idea of an inclusion, which, or a democratization, which in itself seems to kind of, you know, suggest that paradoxes would disappear. Partly because, you know, the dialectic is always kind of going back to some kind of synthesis. And say, well, I mean, you know, the synthesis then in itself would kind of sort of, is always going to be a dialectic. But the dialectic in itself, what does that mean? Is it just a narrative which we have become kind of very comfortable with and we can kind of, you know, cite it whenever we want, just drop it there and then we solve the problem? But actually we haven't solved the problem. So in a way, partly because, you know, I put my attention to art, and that's a choice, and you can kind of look at it in a different way. But I mean, I think, you know, especially contemporary art is kind of defying this. Yesterday we had a very interesting discussion in the Institute of Contemporary Art down in Marsa, and we're discussing the book edited by Ray Fulvell, Across Currents, and it was a very interesting kind of discussion about contemporaneity. But I mean, what I think about, I mean, what I brought up was the whole idea of relevance, but also of becoming irrelevant and rendering stuff as irrelevant. How things kind of move on and how things become more and more irrelevant of what the contemporary might expect. So the whole idea of progress, as we know, and the whole idea of progress is kind of leading towards some kind of relevance in itself is just, again, I think a comfortable kind of way of talking about it. Yet, I don't give up, because I mean, what I think we could bring in, kind of especially the narratives of education, is other stuff which has not dealt with education. For example, we mentioned Laclau, and Laclau, Ernesto Laclau, never talks about education. It's quite interesting. 3 years ago, I invited him over to Columbia University, and he gave a lecture to the teachers' college. And he told me, I'll do it, but I'm not going to talk about education because I know nothing about it. I told him, as yet, but however, people use your work. They use your emancipations all the time, and there are people coming from education. They find your work extremely relevant. So what's going on there? He said, yeah, well, you do that. And one of the reasons is, so, because, you know, he deals with this whole idea of, you know, emancipation could never be foreclosed, if you like, never been, things like that. The dialectic in itself, you can't just sustain it and you can just sort of drop it in as some kind of password, some kind of shibboleth. So then the following year we had Rancière, and the Lord Rancière talks about the ignorant schoolmaster, and he brings about a kind of a pedagogy which is very interesting. Yet he does not come from the kind of traditional pedagogical and philosophy of education traditions. Yet his work is extremely relevant. So, like Laclau and Rancière, I always look at philosophers who may never have talked about learning, never talked about education, but I find them extremely relevant. And one of them is Gianni Vattimo. Partly because, actually, in Gianni Vattimo, when he starts talking about the whole idea of weak thought, which is called pensiero debole, which actually was, as you know, a debate that actually emerged in the Catholic Church, because the whole idea of weakness, the whole idea of un pensiero debole, which is weak thought, it's kind of strangely translated in English, but it's the whole idea of how thought, how reason has always been too strong, has always dominated the whole thing. I mean, he starts off with Nietzsche's declaration of the death of God, and he says, well, actually, it has nothing to do with the death of God, but it has the idea that to do with the death of a notion of this kind of all-pervasive God, this strength, this strong reason. And he starts moving into this kind of weakness. The weakness which he takes from the concept of kenosis, which is a theological concept of, you know, God makes himself weak by becoming man. Therefore, you know, the idea of figure of Christ. But obviously, you know, Vattimo does not come from a Christian tradition. But he uses that concept as, you know, reason becoming weak. Reason becoming weak, a bit like the ignorant schoolmaster, where it does not presume or it does not assume that it knows. Where knowledge actually is, doesn't even assume that it's going to include. Because that's not, it's not the business to include as such, but actually inclusion or emancipation comes later, if you like. It comes as a result of allowing a dialogue or a discussion or a polemic through the indefinable. The master reason is not a master of kind of this master knowledge, master narrative come in and tells you exactly how the whole thing is going to work, but rather actually you work it out from the contingencies. And this is where it becomes interesting, because it starts linking up with some interesting characters in pragmatism as well. It comes up with the kind of interesting characters like, for example, Stanley Cavell, who talks about the ordinary. It brings up a lot of interesting links with contemporary art in terms of, or the arts, in terms of how the contemporary arts evaluate the common, the, you know, the everyday, the quotidian. So an argument for weak thought also brings up the whole idea of, you know, the traditional Marxist aesthetics has always sort of focused on the whole idea of the real, the whole idea of reality. And what is reality? And that was the big sort of debate of what is realism? What does that do? Or should it form? Or should it deal with essence? Should it deal with content or with form? But actually, that becomes kind of secondary to an idea of engaging with the ordinary, and then the ordinary starts kind of, you know, engaging with, and reality in itself becomes weak. So again, within the frame, if we go back to the framework of contemporary art practice as that kind of relating to a polity, but also through pedagogy as a space where polemic takes place or is privileged, where the indefinable is freely assumed because it allows us to think of possibilities which we never thought about. You can't think of imagination as something which is in front of you. You know, Sartre says you cannot imagine a horse if it's in front of you. You have to imagine something which you've never seen. Otherwise you can't imagine it. Okay, you can put bits and pieces of, you know, it's a bit like science fiction. When they paint science fiction figures, they paint things which we've known, like, you know, Harry Potter, for example. They're all kind of, you know, identifiable bits and pieces which then form this kind of new animal, if you like. But, I mean, the possibilities beyond that could be much more challenging in terms of how we learn through the imagination. So in a way, if reality is not overpowering, if we don't kind of aim at having this kind of overpowering reality which then somehow emancipates us, but rather we look at it in terms of a weakness, in terms of weak, but not weakness as in we're not able to do it, but rather as a reality that is not overpowering, is not pervasive, it's not that allows the ability to think of the ordinary and think of the extraordinary through the ordinary, but also think of a universality through fragments of particulars, then the whole game changes. And the whole game changes because what happens is that, you know, if we're talking about democracy, we don't talk about the assumption that democracy works in this kind of sort of, you know, event which then enacts democracy, you know, elections or revolution or something like that. But actually democracy does not happen, it happens all the time, and it changes all the time. It changes its kind of its own definition, because it is a space that allows us to think of the possible, which wasn't possible before. So that then brings in these kind of mechanisms in terms of learning, which could be identified, and again using the kind of, you know, what we get from, or how we engage with, or how we talk about contemporary art, that starts using things like irony, it starts using things like, you know, happiness, it starts talking about friendship, it starts talking about recurrence, it starts talking about repetition. You know, you think about Boyce and you think about the work of Abramovich, Marina Abramovich, you talk about repetition, you talk about acts which are repeated on and on and on without any meaning. You say, why on earth is this performing artist sort of, you know, keeps kind of going around hitting the wall? Or why on earth is the... Marina Abramovich has got this piece which is very interesting, where she is directing a bow and arrow towards her, and she's holding it like that. So there's this tension, and you're expecting that this tension is suddenly going to give way and, you know, kill herself. What's going on there? What's this tension kind of giving, teaching her? So this whole kind of, you know, categories which are normally not assumed, may be too risky in learning contexts, may be too transgressive in terms of the school, these have to come in there. They have to start talking about, you know, third spaces. They have to talk about other spaces. And we also have to start thinking in ways which maybe haven't sort of been assumed as being viable. For example, we can start thinking about revolution as in terms of impasse, or impasse, as the Americans say. And what does that mean? So you could say, well, if you have a situation where there's an impasse, that doesn't mean that there's going to be this kind of sort of paradoxical event, or this apotheotic event where suddenly the big event comes in and, you know, hell breaks loose and that's it, there's change. But we're talking about, you know, the whole question of a situation of paralysis, within which then we can start thinking about a pause, and some of the stuff about, you know, an excuse to pause in my previous stuff, within which that pause then we can kind of regain some form of power to be able to think about things and act about things in a different way. I don't like using the word postmodernity, like some of my colleagues do, especially yesterday. So postmodernity was the word of the day. It was the shibboleth, because partly is, I think, it's something which kind of leaves us with some kind of definition that makes us comfortable. But surely we are. I would like to think that now we are in a position. Not that before we weren't, by the way, because, I mean, you know, if you read, even if you read Spinoza, you find the same moments of postmodernity in inverted commas that we can find now, where there is these kind of sort of, you know, moments of not only transition, because that implies that now we're going to somehow find this new narrative and we're going to be comfortable and we're going to move there. But there are these kind of tensions. It's a bit like Marina Abramovich's tension of the arrow and the bow, which are always there, which are never going to be resolved, but which are also, if anything, an excuse, a political excuse, for us to do something. And this, to me, this is what contemporary art, but also art in general, is to me. It's an excuse. There's no justification. You can take art out. Okay, you could argue. You can't say that art is there for us to engage with beautiful buildings. You can't say aesthetics is teaching us notions of beauty, because actually aesthetics doesn't deal only with beauty. But definitely, it does allow us to take on an excuse, and within that kind of excuse we can then find a space to polemicize, but also to engage with the indefinable, so that we don't need to be afraid of a very powerful, strong thought, but also to appreciate what we have. So there is not a sense of desperation there, where, because people keep saying, oh, postmodernity leaves us with nothing, so we are desperate. But actually, that's why I don't use the word, because for me, actually, it's always a notion of hope. And the hope lies in an assumption that the ground itself is not that powerful, that maybe there's no ground. And doesn't matter, because the ground, we make it. So whether we have it, I'd rather make it than receive it from somewhere else. You know, once someone told me, you know, you'd rather have your own God than someone gives it to you. So you can do whatever you like with it. And that's quite an interesting concept. So that's what, to me, contemporary art means. And that's what, to me, an arts polity would imply. That kind of polity would be pedagogical because it allows the polemical and the indefinable in it. But it is a polity because I think it has responsibilities. It has political responsibilities. And sometimes we talk a lot about methodologies in academia. We engage with methodologies as if this kind of fetish. You know, if you get the methodology right, you're going to get your dissertation right. So some people say, if you get your methodology wrong, then all your project is gone. But actually, you know, that becomes kind of another fetish. I'd rather say, well, you make it as you go, and you move on. And if we have that possibility, then that for me becomes a kind of a polity that allows us to do that. So it's, you can say, okay, you're making excuses, you're creating a whole situation to be comfortable in. I don't want to be comfortable in it, but also I want to have hope. Not me personally, but I want us to engage with hope, because I think if we don't have that, then politically we're in trouble. And I just leave it there for now. And hopefully we'll open the discussion. So I'm sorry I kind of bombarded you with a lot of things. I didn't want to be jargon, so hopefully I didn't use too much of it. Just a way of speaking. And thank you so much.
Would anybody like to make an intervention? Where are the limits of critical pedagogy here?
Well, in critical pedagogy itself. It's posing its limits, actually, I think, and that's the big problem. And it's posing itself as a limit, because what it's doing, I think, is that, you know, as I said, with the dialectic and with all the other stuff, it's kind of becoming too comfortable with it. And I think, and I'm sympathetic, you know, I'm saying this from a sympathetic point of view, not from someone who's coming from another kind of planet, but I'm saying that I think we are at a stage where we have to kind of critique that. Partly because, you know, I mean, we had the same critique with Marxism and stuff like that. I don't think critical pedagogy picked it up. I mean, they still insist, no, we can't do that. I think, you know, reality out there proves otherwise, so, because it's not that simple.
Okay, let's try to keep the whole thing jargon-free, because it is a discourse which lends itself incredibly to jargon. If 9/11, you know, put the last nail on the coffin of the, you know, Fukuyama's delusion that things, you know, history ended with the fall of the Berlin Wall, it certainly removed the last nail on another coffin, and loads of funny things, you know, stinking, disgusting things came out of this coffin. One of them you pointed at. And then left there. And I think it's probably a good point where to start a jargon-free discussion, and that's the issue of inclusiveness. To start with the issue of inclusiveness in general, and then inclusiveness and art, with special attention to art education. We certainly have been faced in most of Europe over the last 48 months, at least, with situations, including the intervention of artists, whatever that means, either challenging inclusiveness, or appearing to be practicing it. So if you have, as a reaction to popular, perhaps justified worries about fundamentalism in its various forms, and not necessarily just Islamic, but the interventions appear to be exclusive as opposed to inclusive. In other words, if a particular fundamentalism appears to be exclusive, you react to it by excluding it. And you exclude it because it seems to be an enemy of inclusiveness. more often than not, and we could look at each case of this, I mean, the Dutch case is one of the best, or the one of the best covered by the media. In each of these cases, what you have is an act that appears to be in favor of inclusiveness, essentially excluding someone else's view. The whole thing of what is progressive and what isn't, you began with that, at that point becomes extremely crucial. One, because it appears obvious that we may have to drop the notion altogether. And we may have to drop the notion of inclusiveness. And we may finally have to find the courage to make statements. Statements which, given that we have no more meta-narratives, statements which find no pretense of universal justification. Okay, perhaps you can take it from there and look at art and education and educating artists or educating people to look at art from that point of view.
I'm very grateful because actually you put it better than I would. Because actually that's the big problem that I think the whole question of inclusiveness comes in. As you know, there is a big debate in art education about, well, I mean, big debate, it's a storm in a teacup, but I mean, you know, they think they kind of sort of thing. But the thing is that we need to bear in mind is that art education as a discipline has its own kind of, you know, groups and... but there has been an interesting debate in terms of people who wanted to eliminate the aesthetic, cross it out in a Heideggerian way, which is kind of childish. And those who are, and they are arguing that basically what we're doing in schools and outside the school is that you have already popular culture and you have all these kind of forms which are very radical in terms of how, you know, so they cite websites and all that kind of stuff and advertisements and whatnot, TVs, where actually, you know, the young persons, the people, the kids, let's talk about the children here, they seem to kind of relate to that very quickly. And so why impose on them these kind of aesthetic kind of ideas, these kind of this art of the museum, which is very alien to them? So that's one argument in terms of inclusiveness, that is kind of, which is very much characterized by what you're saying. I mean, you put that in a, because politically speaking, if you think about that in political terms, as you put it out there, you know, for example, the whole idea of fundamentalism, that particular argument doesn't solve it, because in a way, as you said, we need to make statements. And I think, you know, whether meta-narratives exist or not, I mean, that's another thing which I think has become kind of too much of a jar and too much comfortable. We can state that and we're done. But I don't think that helps anymore, because personally I think that the statements are not theirs yet. And I think actually academia is becoming more and more apolitical. With all the arguments that are there for progressive education, for critical theory, for critical practice and all that kind of, and not just in education, in other social sciences especially, the statements politically are not there. They're not being taken out there. Although they seem to be taken there, and the kind of there's vociferous stuff. But it seems to me that when you think about it, the kind of much more conservative forms of exclusiveness seem to kind of use some of these equivocacies, some of these paradoxes, in their own sort of favor. And to me, this is historical, and this is where I agree with you that, you know, 9/11 has kind of, you know, this whole myth of not end of history has gone. In a way, it's kind of strange that it took some, like a kind of huge tragedy like that to suddenly go back to our senses. I mean, not to mention Darfur and all the other stuff. Suddenly we have to make statements, but no one is making statements. And that kind of gap, that kind of sort of, you know, vacuum, reminds me very much of the vacuum left by liberal governments in the beginning of the century. I mean, like Italy. I'm not saying fascism is coming back in that kind of sort of way, but there seems to be those kind of conditions which sort of keep repeating themselves in terms of leaving a vacuum, you know, with the left becoming in its kind of becoming more in disarray and more sort of domesticated and not very, very clear in terms of making statements. And on the other hand, you have the kind of, you know, the failure of liberalism leaves this kind of big yawning gap, which then, whatever takes place, becomes kind of problematic. So I think politically that's very, very scary. And this is why we can't take it for granted, even notions of exclusiveness. I'm not saying, you know, suddenly these words, they don't mean anything, partly because that's what the jargon is all about and that's the new fashion. I think it's not a new fashion at all. I think we've seen it happening, you know, 100 years ago. I've seen it happening, I mean, I always had a very strong interest in futurism and that kind of particular period in contemporary in modernity, the avant-garde, historical avant-garde, but within the context of what was happening, say, for example, in Italy with the Giolitti government and with the whole anarcho-syndicalist stuff and you know, the Socialist Party of Turati being split and all that kind of stuff. But that particular period is very interesting. It's interesting also how the late Gillian Rose, there is a point where she said, you know, the gray area of the postmodern now is settling down. Once that settles down, we have to pick up the questions that we left behind when liberalism failed. And I think the point of history when liberalism failed, actually, you know, it's not now, but it's far away. But somehow we are facing that. I mean, unfortunately, Gillian, you know, died very young, and she left us with some interesting books. But you know, those statements, that discussion, I don't think we have picked it up as yet. So, to me, that's what I would like to get at. I'm still not sure whether I have articulated it, but I mean, that's where I would like to go.
You seem to be advocating kind of ethics in teaching, and I get the impression it's based on a certain ontology. The expression which came across in your talk very, very strongly was the indefinable, engaging with the indefinable, and it seems to me that phrase, did I hear you say, relate the indefinable to a strong core? I'm not sure I heard that phrase. But
I might have.
Yeah. And could you talk a bit more about this whole area? Because I get the feeling it informs your whole ethic of what teaching is all about.
I'm very grateful for your question, because actually that's something which is, you know, when we talk about aesthetics education, especially, I mean, you find stuff in Maxine Green's work as well as others, that, as we know with Lukács, George Lukács, and I have to mention him because, I mean, he's been one of my kind of, you know, I've studied his work, I've been very engaged with his work when I finished my undergraduate and moving on to my doctorate, partly because that was the time when the Berlin Wall, I think, was falling apart, but also when I was always interested in modernity, and I was always kind of, you know, curious about how this man can develop such a very sophisticated dialectic in terms of how he talks about the aesthetic. You know, his book, The Aesthetic, the huge one, is kind of... But then when it comes to modernity, he kind of stops there. And he stops for ethical reasons. I mean, unfortunately, his ontology never came out because he died. We have fragments of that. But, I mean, the idea of an aesthetics ethics, or the ethics within aesthetics, and how that links, is very kind of very much there. And I mean, when you then move into a kind of Adorno.
Are you talking about Foucault?
No, I'm talking about Lukács, George Lukács.
Okay, thank you.
The Hungarian Marxist philosopher. Because there is a humanist argument there. And as you know, I mean, you know, humanism has come under critique as well. Now, we don't want to go there, but actually the whole question of ethics has somehow become a casualty in terms of the fact that some of the kind of certainties, particularly, I mean, you know, let's talk about the left here, because that's kind of highly relevant. We're going to have a statement. I think the statements that, you know, Mario was mentioning, to me, they need to come from a certain political position. And let's make no bones about that. The political position has to come from what we traditionally used to call that. Now, whether you call it something else, that's fine. But, I mean, it has to come from a position which has to do with social justice, whatever that means, but it has to do with issues of, you know, a democracy that is not simply a formalist democracy, that is based on some kind of, you know, formalized system which we have been used to. There might be something different here. But definitely the ethics need to come in there. And the problem is that when Lukács kind of brings in the whole idea of realism and why he went for Thomas Mann and not for others, and why he only talked about Solzhenitsyn just before he died and rewrote his sort of, you know, his position on that. The issue has to do with ethics and had to do with his preoccupation with the teleology. It had to do with the human being's rights to have what he called teleological projects. Now that seems to have kind of disappeared, partly because we say, well, we can't be teleological because that kind of, you know, forecloses any possibility. It becomes, you know, it takes out meaninglessness. But maybe we can talk about the teleology in a different way. Maybe with teleology in a different way. Maybe we can start talking about ethics in a totally different way. That ethics is not presupposed from, and we, And here, I mean, you know, I'm not critical of the pragmatists. Here we might have to thank the pragmatists for it, might have to thank people like Havel. Where we start talking about ethics from within the particulars. We might talk about ethics from within everyday life. But also being mindful of the fact that, again, these kind of debates were already there in the beginning of the century. I mean, you know, we already had issues dealing with that, say, in Bergson and in other theorists which influenced the avant-garde, the historical avant-garde. So I don't think we're totally in a new uncharted territory here, but surely the whole issue of ethics has to come in. Because again, I mean, if you take the Malta, and I mean, you know, my engagement with Malta is through the internet. So I mean, I read the Times online, I read all the other journals online, whatever I can find. And but also I'm interested in issues of civil rights and stuff like that. But I mean, I'm interested in societies which are mainly, I know this is close to your heart, issues of you know, Catholicism and stuff like that. But I mean, you know, when you have a society which has had a particular ethical kind of code which we were brought up into, good or bad or neither, then the ethics seem to have been kind of, you know, confused with morality. And I think education itself, you know, even in schooling, that seems to be, have been something which we didn't kind of, you know, think about. We just assume, at least for example in the context of Malta, we just assume, well, you know, this is the church, so I mean ethics comes from there. But actually it doesn't. Ethics is not morality, ethics is a different context. Why not ethics? You know, I think actually, you know, I think the arts have kind of very strong ethical issues which they bring up. And that's why they scare people, that's why, you know, people get scandalized by it. I'm not saying, you know, art is the or everything, but and a panacea. But definitely, I think ethics needs to come from various positions. But sometimes we fail to bring it in, partly because, well, I don't know why, but partly because we are refusing to make the statements, and the statements need to be done, and they have to have ethical implications as much as you know. That's why they are political. So definitely, yeah, I'm very much concerned with that. Personally, because I think, you know, even methodologically speaking, when people talk about methods, you know, the political implications there are also ethical implications, because they seem to kind of promote a certain kind of certainty, or kind of sound of scientific argument, which leaves a lot of stuff behind. It leaves affection behind, it leaves care. For example, I was had a student doing work on care, and whenever she talks about care, people become very strongly opposed to her and could never understand it. I mean, okay, there is a reason for it, maybe because she comes from the South and she's in New York and she's talking about care from a kind of slightly different position. She's very Christian, but that's fine. But I mean, when you're talking about care, people just sort of, you know, goes, oh, no, hang on a minute. And we're talking about liberals here. We're talking about liberal rational students. Yeah, they say this is not rational, you can't do it, it's not measurable, and no, how did that? And so, but I mean, I think care is an important concept. Yeah, I mean, we know about friendship and Derrida and all that kind of stuff, but I mean, I think these are very important concepts, but I think they get sort of mixed up with religious and ideological narratives, which sometimes, and this is where the meta-narrative problem, you know, comes in. But definitely, that does not mean that we are absolved from making statements. We have to make statements, that's why we have to take ethical responsibility. Maybe, you know, George Lukács was right when he talks about teleological projects. We need to have teleological projects, and we maybe have to take responsibility for them, rather than expect some kind of political party or some kind of body that you know, accommodates those. Maybe that's the big problem.
John, in a profession where, you know, the definable is privileged,
yeah,
and control is becoming increasingly centralized and therefore by implication hegemony reproduced, how do our teachers engage your discourse? Do they feel empowered?
Some of them do, others don't. And particularly the big problem is that art becomes an instrument. So some of them, and remember, this is the other thing, is that education is still dominated by, and I mean, I'm not being disrespectful for it, but it has been dominated both by the social sciences, but also by cognitive psychology. So when it comes to art education, sometimes when you read this stuff, the canon is very much linked to cognitive stuff. So the art becomes a way of, you know, growth. It becomes for the child to grow and all that kind of. I mean, that's important, but I think that kind of criticality, which you find in even within aesthetics education, as promoted by, say, Maxine in the Lincoln Center. I don't know whether you know, but there's a whole school of thought which came out of the Lincoln Center, where they talk about aesthetics education as they bring artists, who are not trained as teachers, and they look at, they try to sort of elicit from their art form the inherent pedagogical kind of relevance, if you like. Somehow it gets formalized in some kind of form of teaching. Now, that's kind of tries to take to go beyond that. But even that, you'll find that it eventually, it's there's a very interesting phrase in computers which goes snap to grid. Have you ever seen that? If you're dealing with design or graphics, you snap back to grid. So it snaps back to a grid. So I mean, even if you put it snap to grid, so all the lines are kind of, you know, it goes linear. It becomes kind of much more aligned to it. And somehow they snap back to the grid of cognitive science. And I think that's a problem. Now, there are some others, especially, these people who talk about crossing out the aesthetics, maybe they are dealing with that stuff as well. Because remember, sometimes aesthetics education is also very much cognitive. So they bring up, you know, the usual suspects in there. But I think there is a growing, and especially I would see this more in terms of art schools rather than in primary and secondary schools. In art schools, the big challenge is, even for practitioners who are there, who are the artists who are showing, the big challenge is from students coming in with demands, who see art, contemporary art out there, and they see it and they say, well, this is what we want to do. And then somehow they find themselves in the studio dynamic, which becomes very much kind of, it has a certain kind of way of either cloning students or, you know, the usual problem in education. And that becomes an interesting kind of dynamic there, because the student still, you know, the art student is meant or thinks of herself as meaning that she must be critical all the time. So that kind of criticality within art students in art schools, I always found that very interesting. I always found that these students, although they haven't read critical theory, because I used to teach critical theory in art schools, they come in with already concepts that are kind of, you know, in their work, which we assume already those. There's a disposition to it, yeah, to use Dewey's concept. There's a disposition, actually, towards this kind of thinking. And I think that's where it works better. And I mean, in countries like in the United Kingdom, where there are very strong forms of accountability in teaching in the universities because of CA, you know, the agencies there, that somehow kind of focused the minds in terms of people talking about how we teach in higher education. And that's something which in a way, it kind of, you know, it also started affecting ways of teaching there. But also, you know, part, I think the strongest leverage there is to do with the demands that the students are coming with, the dispositions that they're coming with, which in a way somehow comes from popular culture as well, so let's not eliminate that. But also it comes from this kind of need of a criticality which is may not be as political, overtly political, as we've seen in the 60s or stuff like that. It might be, you know, dealing with issues of sexuality. It might be dealing with, sometimes it becomes very solipsistic. And sometimes that's the big struggle with the student, because you don't want them to be kind of, you know, navel-gazing all the time. But somehow there is a predisposition which could be tapped into and actually could work really, really powerful. And in fact, they say, and I mean, this sounds odd, that it's a bit like philosophers, because I always wonder, what do people do when they do philosophy, you know, as a degree? They become good managers, apparently. And I think artists, actually, they're becoming very, very good in terms of that kind of sphere. But also, you see how these days they're talking about the MFA, the Master of Fine Arts, as being the new MBA. And you're finding people in, say, for example, Harvard Business School, there are a couple of people there who are using art methods, how the artist develops or goes about developing a problem. And they use those, actually, as kind of, they try to use them as models, which, you know, kind of becomes instrumental. But anyway, but they try to use those kind of forms of thinking into problem solving. And now you might say, and probably you could, so one could become very skeptical about these things. But on the other hand, you know, at least there is a recognition of that kind of criticality there.
Bringing this to Maxine Green.
Yeah.
We spoke about this yesterday, actually. The phrase, you hinted at it at one stage, extraordinary re-experiencing the ordinary.
Yeah.
Do you see that as an important element in education of the imagination and art in particular?
Yeah. I think the context of Maxine is also important in terms of... Yeah, yeah. I'll explain that, because I mean, I think one of the things which we should mention as well, which I found very interesting, and remember, I was going into America with, like everyone else, with preconceived ideas, and also with certain kind of forms of not prejudice, but you know, America have these kind of things, and then you come in also with from a kind of a European point of view. But then suddenly you start discovering things which become very interesting in terms of, for example, how American philosophers in themselves offered, they really talk about hope, and they really talk about possibility, and they really talk about the extraordinary. And I think it kind of dawned on me when I was watching the Obama campaign, and how, you know, how different that is. Say, for example, I was in Britain when Tony Blair came to power, and that was an electric time. I can tell you that. I mean, people were very excited about this new beginning. They're very excited about New Labour. They were very excited about, you know, the idea of how these kind of sort of new possibilities came in. But obviously, you know, Tony Blair was the prime minister. That's it. With Obama, and I mean, this might be a kind of, you know, and I talk about this in the book in terms of Jefferson, in terms of the whole idea of liberty and the whole idea of negative and positive freedom, which is a big thing which we don't want to go into here. But I mean, it's always there, the whole idea whether freedom should be a positive freedom which has an ethical kind of thing which sustains, or whether freedom is just, you know, the question of not having any barriers. And you see, you know, this man becomes president. You can become, I mean, in Britain you can't become the king or the queen because you have to be part of that family. So I know these are symbols, but actually, you know, for that kind of extraordinary thing comes in. And you see in the campaign, there was a lot of playfulness on this kind of notion, you know, how something becomes possible. The whole idea of the American dream, now whether we like it, whether we agree with it or not, it's always there. The whole idea of I'm an ordinary bloke, I come from the situation, you know, I had all the problems in my life, and yet I can do it. And you can all do it. And it wasn't just a catchphrase, it was something which people really believe in. You know, you're engaging with people who never been interested in politics before. And suddenly they sort of see that. And that's partly because it is ingrained in this notion. So, I mean, and I see in Maxine a lot of work in there. The other thing which is interesting is Maxine recently said, she was talking about the whole idea of how Martin Luther King's dream is fiction. You know, she said, remember, the dream, I have a dream, is a fiction. It's a story. And yet the story could become possible. And, you know, the whole idea of yes, we can is fiction. It's a story. We are telling a story to each other. I mean, you know, Martin Luther King was living in segregation. This is fiction. The dream could never happen. So at this stage, it is still fiction. It's still a story I'm telling you. But then how does that story, how that kind of, you know, semblance, how the semblance enters reality? How does the desire become truth? And we also know that when it becomes truth, it's not the exact truth as we desired it. We know that it's never going to be. It's always a work in progress. It's always a potentiality, if you like. It's a bit like, you know, what Aristotle talks about in terms of potentiality and actuality. It's always potentiality. It's always energia, not dynamis. One of them. Yeah, it's always dynamis. It's always potentiality and never actuality. And Marx actually talks a lot about that in his Grundrisse, when he talks about, you know, capital and labor, and how labor in itself is this kind of notion of potentiality, which makes capitalism even worse, because what it does is you take out that potentiality and estrange it from what that potentiality can do to the maker. Again, to take the maker further into the poetics, which then takes it into art, that kind of whole corollary, that kind of structure actually becomes very interesting, especially if you start thinking about it in terms of education. So the ordinary and the extraordinary, probably, they are part and parcel of each other.
Yeah, but the way she uses it is also in terms of praxis.
Yes.
I mean, how a work of art, or any work of the imagination, right, that makes you rethink situations, which I think we saw also in Rafel's book, to which you contributed.
Yeah.
I just want to ask, because your reference to Tony Blair and people's optimism brings one to the present and the somewhat more muted optimism,
exactly,
which greeted what some people on the right are calling America's Tony Blair. Now, already, you see. And, of course, this makes me ask you, partly, to what extent is your thinking related to an American school system, an American classroom? To what extent is your thinking related to what I will call a European one? Because America has a whole ideology of hope.
Yeah.
Hope is part of the entire hegemonic discourse, you might want to say, of America. Whether you're on the right or on the left, you're always urging people to hope.
Yeah.
And this is one of the most powerful encouragements any system could ever have.
Mm-hmm.
It's always potential. It's always going to get better, no matter what it's doing, no matter what it's destroying, you see? So I think that
hope is a difficult word.
It's an important qualifier in terms of the context of American history. I mean, as I said before, when I'm dealing with education, I tend to go beyond schooling, partly because the schooling in and of itself is, I think, and this is where actually the whole idea of the Tony Blair is interesting in terms of education. I mean, Obama's recent soundings on education are very much meritocratic. They are exactly, similar kind of, I mean, there's a very interesting thing about the British system and the American system of education. They seem to kind of bounce off each other the same mistakes and the same examples. They use the same models. And you pick them up from Republicans, the whole idea of vouchers, the conservatives, the Tories pick it up. And the Democrats and New Labour, which is not so new anymore, they kind of pick up the whole idea of meritocracy. And I don't know whether, you read my book, actually, Maxine Green stands was against meritocracy. The whole idea of meritocracy there, this is why where you have this kind of American context, but then she goes beyond that. And what is interesting about it is when I saw the students, I mean, a lot of students who flock to her classes and how they engage with her work, normally they take that kind of notion of hope at face value. And this year I did a whole course on her work, which was kind of, normally they listen to her. This time we looked at her work separately from her and then bringing in this whole kind of tradition of continental philosophy especially. And suddenly you start seeing that kind of sort of questioning. Because, I mean, you could start questioning her, and you need to question her work as well. You need to start questioning the idea of hope. You need to start questioning the whole hegemony, if you like. But definitely there is that kind of, predisposition which might allow a certain, if probably you infuse in it the idea of uncertainty, which actually hope in an American context seems to be kind of much more anchored into this kind of certainty. If you believe in it, you're going to do it. And maybe, the example of Tony Blair could be a very good kind of example in terms of how you have a government that sort of, did marvelous changes in education system, very strong stuff in health and all that kind of stuff, but then suddenly you have a kind of a whole premise which somehow went sour, which is the premise of meritocracy. Which is also interesting because actually Labour in Britain has never had that kind of tradition of meritocracy. Blair tries to impose it on it, which somehow never worked. I mean, talk about organically speaking, Labour in Britain has never had, it has a position which is very different from that kind of democratic, meritocratic notion. And I think that's one of the problems. I mean, we talk about the war as a kind of, political event which kind of, brought Blair in, Blair's government in disarray. But I don't think, it's maybe too early, I don't know. Reassessing the Blair legacy, I would say it's more to do with the ideology of the so-called third way. It's more to do with the social scientific kind of standpoint that he took from Giddens and all the others. And I think that's where we need to kind of, if we're going to make statements, we have to make those statements. And we have to kind of appreciate some of the stuff, move on. We're not saying, let's go for an old Marxist critique of that stuff and, embrace Arthur Scargill. But I'm saying that definitely, we need to kind of, take into consideration what's going on. It was so fast as well that we didn't have time to discuss this. And it seems there is a seem to be a kind of a dismissive attitude, either a dismissive attitude towards the Blair experiment or simply, people that sort of, they kind of become either ambivalent to it or they just say, well, it was good. But then obviously the war comes in. But definitely there are some very interesting debates going, which went on at that time and how they changed. The other thing we need to kind of not forget is the John Smith era, which was very short, but actually it really shifted historically labor in Britain. But I think it's really exciting in terms of how what's going on now and in terms of those kind of developments. But surely, and as Mario said, it might be that the historical situation now might allow us to start thinking differently. I think definitely the ethical issue comes back. I think definitely the whole idea of how we live comes back. The whole question of living beyond one's means. The whole question of hope will be reassessed ethically. I'm not sure in America, but I think in Europe actually it's already kind of happening. So.
Yes, there is. So U.S. Hope, this apparent reprieve to meta-narratives, the whole hope issue is based on a very potent meta-narrative. On the other hand, Obama does cover his backside.
Yeah,
the in my view, very cleverly sold notion. Look, you know, I read Niebuhr.
Yeah.
I think that is very strong because Niebuhr, if there is one thing that is central to his later work, was the anti-messianic realism. So look, trying to impose what today we would call a meta-narrative is ultimately repressive, dangerous. So, okay, we must hope that at the end of the day, says Niebuhr, don't do more than is realistically possible.
Yeah.
Which sounds very much like let's compromise with what there is. Mm. It's vattimo prevattimo, no? Mm. And the fact that, you know, Obama, you know, begins with, you know, we can, we will, but then, even before getting elected and repeated it recently, yes, but look, you know, I read Niebuhr. And is basically a saying, yes, we're opening a meta-narrative, but we're realistic. So don't expect more than I can give you. The formal excuse is because, look, I mean, I came up on an economic ticket, so don't expect miracles, but I'll do what I can. To do what I can is a very different story than I want to, therefore I can, I will. Mm-hmm. So perhaps the difference is not that enormous. The Blair narrative was not very different. Blair comes, don't forget, at the time when we're talking about the end of meta-narratives.
Exactly.
And what gets a lot of people pissed off is that while the left dropped the meta-narratives and became weak, literally saying yes. I mean, most of the Italian left went for Vattimo, with Cacciari playing around a bit, but then actually at the end of the day accepting it, while the right sounds extremely strong and brings out this meta-narratives. So I don't think that Obama is that, there has never been a more European president than him.
Yeah. I agree, definitely.
I'm going to switch the discussion a bit now.
Please do.
Back to art, the imagination.
Okay.
You spoke about the need for strong statements, yeah, political statements. Now we have a reality, the war, which obviously affects the imagination of people all over the world, but particularly where you're living. And we have young people who are sucked into a militarized culture. That's my reading of the situation from afar. Through a variety of means which capture the imagination, strengthen desire. I'm talking about video games, how important the war is. I mean, people like Henry Giroux have been writing about this a lot, and Chomsky too. And now you've got the specter of the body bags. These young people are coming with missing limbs, etc. How is this affecting art, and particularly art education, from your own experience?
Well, one of the things that's why I mentioned the colleagues working on this kind of visual culture thing, is that they bring up these examples, precisely this whole idea of a militaristic kind of narrative, and then they bring up other narratives which they say, well, in a way, that kind of could allow us to use those kind of mechanisms within which then we can kind of, you know, counter that narrative. I don't think art in itself, I mean, art in itself, how it engages with war, it has always engaged with war in very different ways, in very different manners. I don't particularly think that when art tries, and this is the kind of strange thing about art, is that when art tries, I mean, I think it, sort of Adorno talks about this when he critiques socialist realism somewhere, albeit maybe, no, actually even directly, where he says, well, the more art, I mean, I'm not quoting him, I'm just paraphrasing, it seems to me, my reading is the more political art tries to be, actually, the less it becomes effective politically. So in a way, you know, you're going to engage with art political kind of, art political, whatever it is. It potential, want to call it that, and that sounds odd. It has to assert its own autonomy from that kind of political narrative. And then somehow it kind of works. So whether art education is going to become then, in the context of visual culture, a kind of purveyor of these kind of counter-narratives, which is very dangerous because then that becomes not a statement, as I'm thinking of, but it becomes more of an instrumentalized kind of set of platitudes which don't really work because they become too kind of benign and they somehow, students, you know, young people see through them because they are much more sophisticated.
I am interested about your concept of pensiero debole, because to a certain extent it is a contradiction in terms when it looked at Western culture. And I'm using on purpose the idea of Western culture. First, because this idea is coming from Europe, no? Of a pensiero debole, but at the same time, this Christian art is, the Christian art or Western art, let's put it that way, but if we would like say, is inspired from Christianity, very vaguely, but still there, is the most important or dominant art in the world, in terms of a tangible art. Let's say an example. Italy claims to have, I think it's three-fourth of world patrimony in terms of art. Now, how this can be related to aesthetics, that is a problem. But then on the other hand, we tend to forget, from a Western perspective, the Far East, for example, which they also have a very strong art. And also we're discovering not only the tangible art, but also the intangible art. And therefore, this idea, how far we can talk of pensiero debole, I understood well what you want to mean, but in terms of aesthetics, because this pensiero debole became pensiero forte in terms of aesthetics. This whole lecture was based on Western, let's say, view of aesthetics.
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that it was a Western view. I mean, obviously it's taking kind of a context, it takes place within the context of, I'm not sure, okay, let's put it this way. I mean, I think probably I'm not doing any justice to Vattimo here, but the way I read pensiero debole is that within Vattimo you have two, I mean, in his alternate interpretation, he talks about this kind of koine between what he talks about, nihilism on one side and hermeneutics on the other. And as you know, I mean, he studied with Gadamer, and so he's bringing in hermeneutics, the whole idea that all we have are interpretations. The whole question that we are kind of, you know, bound within the kind of limit of what we interpret. And I would say that's the way I see the notion of truth, which I don't think it's relative. It's to do with the fact that the truth is the limit, and the limit in itself is the truth that allows us to talk about truth and not about, you know, truths as and then become relativist. And that's, again, there's a political issue in there. But, I mean, I think the kind of aesthetics I'm thinking about, and this is why I didn't bring any I brought a couple of examples from contemporary art, but I think contemporary art in and of itself is not as westernized as we think, because it pays a lot of attention to the critique of Orientalism that we had before, and also it does not, I don't think it allows itself to a pensiero forte. And also I would say that if you want to talk about pensiero debole, we're going to mention him today, sorry. I know Caravaggio is very famous and popular in Malta. My reading may be totally different. But, I mean, if we're talking about, even in Christianity, if we're talking about artists who really were kind of radical in terms of how they brought in the concept of pensiero debole in there, if you talk about, you know, people like Caravaggio and others, especially the Mannerists, where the Mannerists were talking about, we're talking about the human condition. The human condition, they're using it from the quotidianity, which actually, you know, pissed off the church. And some of that stuff was just rejected by the church, partly because what they were saying is, here we have the radical, and they're bringing a radical kind of essence of humanity up to the fore, and we're putting it up on an altar. So I don't think that's pensiero forte at all, and I think it's sort of anticipated. The other thing is that within the context of Vattimo, we need to bear in mind that here we have a critique, and Mario mentioned the left in Italy, and why they go for him, is partly because, and I'm not sure whether this notion of expiation from the left, you know, they want to feel kind of, you know, sorry for it. Is the high idea that we were so much dominated by ideologies that now what we want to do is go back to the quotidian and talk about, you know, weakness, in order then to be able to kind of understand, you know, the meek. I mean, another person I didn't mention was Bobbio. So we talk about Bobbio. I mean, that's another kind of. So if you talk about Norberto Bobbio, there's a book which is translated in English, something to do with the meek. And again, there is this kind of interesting concept about, you know, the meek and the weak. And which goes back to the idea, you know, Maxine talks about the invisible, those people who are invisible, they are poor, they are invisible to the school, they are invisible to, you know, to the system, they are invisible, they're out there. I think in terms of art, I think the art makes the invisible visible. And I think contemporary art particularly, has tried very hard, probably. I mean, you know, you talk about boys, but also you talk about contemporary artists, trying very hard to not to fall within these kind of traps of an all-powerful narrative.
There is an irony in what you're saying, because if there is something with an analog in art that reminds you of the pensiero debole, and the pensiero debole is not a surrender to things. I mean, Latimo makes it very clear. Don't impose any particular reason, given that there isn't a reason, any particular reason on history, so don't overdo it. That's basically all it is. Hmm. But if there is something which reminds you that, in, you mentioned Italy, but we could go further, in art in Italy is the only real period of Christian art, which is, you know, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th century, when there was a conscious effort no longer to push the extremely strong realism you find at the end of the Roman period and the late Hellenic period, and you go for these almost iconic, I mean, look at the friezes in the early sarcophagi in the Vatican. It looks like the geometric style of early Greece. Features go, and the philosophy behind it was very clear, very, very articulated. Who are we to impose features on unformed matter? That's up to God. So if there is anything Vattimo corresponds to, is the really, truly Christian period, very primitive in Italian art. So let's not attempt to make these, you know, overarching sketches on even Italian history on its own, because it's extremely complex. So the early Christian, the only truly Christian, because then it, as the popes themselves noticed, the humanists were taking over and overdoing it a bit, hence the Inquisition. But the truly Christian period in Italian art is where you had pensiero debole.
And I think it's interesting because also you can have other parallels. For example, you know, the whole idea of when Vattimo was doing his work in the 60s, and Italy actually, as you know, it was kind of eclipsed eventually in the avant-garde. I mean, after futurism, you see some of the futurists. I'm fascinated by Carrà, for example, how Carrà, from being the kind of grand futurist, I mean, Boccioni died, so I mean, he couldn't do that, but how Carrà then suddenly moved into metaphysical art, and he wasn't copying, you know, De Chirico's art. But anyway, and he was moving into this kind of much more symbolic art, and there's a piece which is the Antigraziosa and a couple of others in 1916, which are fascinating stuff, which actually I'm writing on. I'm going to open the book with those kind of examples. But also how that suddenly developed into Arte Povera and all the other stuff. I mean, I heard someone from, a colleague from Brussels, who starts talking about not weak pedagogy, but poor pedagogy. And it's an interesting, so it's not, this is not something which kind of I just came up with, but I mean, it's all there. It's very, very interesting stuff going on there.
Thank you for a wonderful exposition. Well, wish you good luck with the book.
Thank you.
It's coming out. When is it coming out?
I don't know. Well, hopefully, you know, by January 2010. So by then I'll be in time.
That's the one art's way out.
Yes.
You have just listened to a talk as part of the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Art's Pedagogical Polity. This talk was delivered by Professor John Baldacchino, Associate Professor of Art and Art Education at Columbia University Teachers College, New York.